The thing I like about sustainability is it's a philosophy about how we should and can design, construct, and operate buildings, and we get to be sort of the last generalist.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Beyond. I'm your host, Brandon Aaron Gibbs, founder of the course platform IAM Studio and director of Studio Motion Form.
If you are interested in learning more about architecture technology and the latest industry methods, check out our sponsor, thinkparametric.com, and check out the Think Parametric newsletter this week in architecture.
Hello everyone, this is Brandon. I'm host of the Architecture Beyond podcast. And today we have a treat for you with a great sustainability leader. I'll just give a little bit of the bio. We have the opportunity to speak with Blake Jackson, a highly accomplished sustainability professional as Director of Sustainability at NORR. Blake leads the firm's global program in achieving the AIA 2030 commitment, as well as the SE, which is for engineers, 2050 challenge. He's dedicated to humanizing architecture and improving the lives of all sorts of people throughout his work, emphasizing the value of sustainable design and its measurable benefits such as quality of air, productivity enhancements, and employee attraction and retention. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Architecture Beyond podcast.
Appreciate it.
So I have a few questions. I've added a few more. Because I think you've done so much for NOR and other firms, and it's just wanted to really dive deep into that. So as an accomplished leader in the field of sustainable architecture, can you share some insights into your background and how you got started in this area of work?
Absolutely. So, I always like to go back to the very beginning whenever I get asked this question. And the older I get, the more I realize the very beginning has so profound of an impact on us before we can even make the conscious effort to decide what we want to do when we grow up, or what we want to be, or how we want to be it when we even accomplish it. And, the longer I live, the more grateful I am for, growing up in a small area, a small rural area outside of Dalton, Georgia. And there's two aspects of that experience that have sort of connected all the tissues to me for my whole of my life. The longer I grow, the more appreciative I am of that humble beginning. But first is Chatsworth, Georgia is about 10 minutes outside of Dalton, Georgia, where about 90% of the world's textiles, carpet, flooring products are manufactured. So most of my family had something to do with the carpet industry. And so as an extension of that, you learn about the social value of manufacturing and the impacts on the environment that manufacturing has, and the impacts on health and well-being of occupants that manufacturing has. And that always played a key role and still plays a key role in my work as a sustainability-focused architect. And the other piece of it that was crucial in my upbringing was that my father, who actually worked in a carpet mill, did that job by day, and at night, he was sort of a local handyman, and I grew up swinging a hammer from the time that I could hold one properly. And my whole childhood was crawling around in attics and crawl spaces and hammering nails and helping him do plumbing and wiring. And so I had a real practical basis for becoming an architect someday. It wasn't until I was older in my life that I realized I had an artistic bend and a philosophical bend, and was able to bring those two spheres together, which I think is something that architecture allows people like myself to be able to do. But those are the areas that got my start in the fascination with how buildings come together, both in terms of the economic side on the manufacturing end, and then on the practical side of actually someone has to physically be able to put them together, at least for now, until the robots take over. But it was very humble beginnings. That transformed into his career.
That's very cool. Georgia is big in manufacturing. I know East Tennessee is. So it's very interesting to find out that basis in Georgia. Is that something that has transformed, or is it something that's still sort of impacting that region?
You know, it's amazing that it's manufacturing that has hung on despite the push to move overseas. There has certainly been a lot of economic dynamism in and around the area. So when I was a child, the city was very famous for a bunch of different things. Like, it was the divorce capital of the world for a while. Johnny Carson pointed that out once, which was a shock, because it's really a small place, right? But it also had the highest per capita number of millionaires because in the 1980s, there were a few hundred independently owned carpet mills. Now, that changed during my lifetime pretty drastically, that they began to be gobbled up by the large multinational conglomerates. So it fundamentally changed the economics of the area, because it became part of a more broadly distributed network of solutions. But, you know, the good thing going for that region, and it's even hard to word it that way politically, right? But what it has going for it is it's a great logistics hub. You can get almost anywhere within a short amount of time from there. The weather is good, and you don't have a lot of unions. And well, the environmental regulations are a little bit lax, too. I will say that is one thing that the carpet industries have gotten better about is improving their impacts on the environment. Because I often joke that growing up in and around the Dalton area in the 80s was like sort of like Bart Simpson and Lisa Simpson growing up in Springfield, you know, and having one industry, and it sometimes was, you know, sometimes the nuclear power plant would let loose radiation. And sometimes when I was growing up, the carpet industries would catch on fire. And, you know, it has some environmental implications, and you don't realize it because you take it for granted because it's right in your backyard.
That's very interesting. I'm interested on that Georgia side about architecture, because again, Georgia's definitely, I would think that's more traditional types of architecture. And your path, how would you sort of connect the architecture side to that? Because I see the sustainability. Where does architecture come in from that background?
Yeah. Good, fantastic question, and a good observation. I mean, you know, think of Georgia, you think of sort of like, you know, Jeffersonian neoclassicism, right? I mean, it's ubiquitous, right? With just this country and that particular region in specifics. However, architecture in Georgia doesn't get recognized the way that it should. So I'll go back to the very beginning of at least sort of the idea of Western architecture in Georgia, and it's the founding of Savannah in 1733. And Savannah is important because it's one of the very few planned cities in the entire continent. And its plan is really the magic behind it. The parks, there's over, I think there were originally 52, I think there's 30 something now, because we lost some of them, and now they're starting to be reimagined and regained from parking structures and things like that. Originally, the city was placed on Yamacraw Bluff in order to command and control the area in and around the Savannah River. And Georgia exists as a buffer between the Carolinas and Spanish Florida. And it was a penal colony for all intents and purposes. But despite that fact, the city of Savannah adapted those parks, which were used for military services, into the public spaces, which were for military services and training and things of that nature, into the parks infrastructure that we have today, which slows down traffic and actually cools the environment and creates these beautiful monumental, you know, very urban but small urban city that is Savannah. And so that's one of its contributions. I could go on and on about some of the more interesting architecture coming out of Georgia, but I'll remind you that Max Goggins and Merrill Elam are from Georgia, and they were instrumental in bringing around not only deconstructivist architecture, but also they taught at the GSD for a long period of time and did some really interesting architectural work in and around the area. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge. You know, I would say probably the most famous architecture from Atlanta and Georgia and Atlanta would be the John Portman, you know, and he did hotels and merchandise marts and all over the world. So, you know, if I'm ever feeling an inkling for a home, you know, I do a lot of business now in Detroit. So there's a Portman building almost every city, so I can step in and it feels like I'm in Atlanta, strangely enough. But we have made a pretty big impact on the global architecture circuit, albeit not as obvious as a city like London or New York or Paris or something like that. But, you know, we hold our own.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the city leadership coming myself from Tennessee, Nashville, we always say, you know, Atlanta is definitely ahead of us, but, you know, Nashville is pushing forward, you know, in terms of, it's also a state conversation as well. Like, you know, Tennessee being so spread across, we just sort of see a little bit of that parallel in Georgia. Georgia's an older brother, you could say.
Right.
from reading your bio, sort of looking also the company profile, you've achieved a lot in your career as director of sustainability. What inspired you to focus on sustainability within the field of architecture, and how have you been able to make such a significant impact?
That's a fantastic question. I summarize that. The answer to that is I got in while the getting was good. I didn't know when I first started architecture that I would pursue a master's degree in sustainable environmental design. And sustainability in architecture was really not a thing that was talked about. It came up in school from time to time, but it was more sort of filtered through the lens of Frank Lloyd Wright and organic architecture and sort of biomimicry or anamorphism or what kind of ism you want to call it, right? So it wasn't its own discipline, and it was driven by aesthetic rigor as opposed to what I would refer to in sustainability talk as sort of inner beauty, right? The metrics behind what makes a building good. Fortunately, when I graduated, it amazes me that it didn't really come into, it was only an elective course that was offered every couple of years, and I didn't get to take it as an undergrad, which shows you the level of influence that it had on architectural education at that time. So I went into the industry and started working in Atlanta for a company called MSTSD, which was a great regional retail architectural firm that did lifestyle centers and entertainment facilities and dinner theaters and things like that. And sustainability wasn't being talked about at all. And I did a project with them that I began maturing not as an architect, but also as a human being. And I just started seeing how things were connected to each other. And I realized that some of the design work that I was doing, and I was doing successful design work. I mean, it was economically viable and the client was happy and the design looked cool in our portfolio. But something was missing, and it was the outcome orientation that sustainability and intentional design makes you strive for, that I realized, like, you know, this building is successful by itself, but it's not part of an ecosystem. It will come as a result of the detriment to the environment that it serves. And that's when I started thinking very differently and realizing that there wasn't a place for this kind of thinking in the industry. And I thought, this is my opportunity to make an impact. I most likely won't be the next great cape-wearing architect. And even if I am, there'll be somebody on the cover of the magazine the next month. So I said, I need to do something that's a little more impactful than that. And that's where I made a departure. And that was around 2006, back when there weren't roles like this in built environment companies, like architecture and engineering firms. And I had the idea of forging a pathway that would become the norm someday. And it that was maybe my one moment of accidental and naive genius, so to speak.
Wow. That makes a lot of sense, because it's aiming for an impact that's not defined by, you know, like a history book, from what I'm understanding.
Yeah, well, it can be too, but I think that I think what I realized is that I spent about 2 years before I made the decision to pursue higher education in that regard, and as you know, found myself in Europe because they're a generation ahead of us thinking about this topic. Even though, ironically, it comes from North America during the oil embargo in the 70s, but that's a whole nother history lesson we can talk about another time. But we lost that, and Europe continued onward with it. But I consumed as much information as I could and realized that I just needed to rent the time to be able to focus on this topic, because I could only teach myself so much, and I wasn't going to get the opportunities to use what I learned except for covertly in the space of architecture as it existed at that time.
I will give the aside, what Blake is talking about is our shared colleague in university at the Architecture Association, where I was part of the design research lab. Blake was part of the sustainability program. And what you're talking about, I think that makes a lot of sense, because you focus in that period on something that you're interested in, which is a big professional step. It's not even really school, because it's a graduate, it's a master's program. No, where you're the teacher, you're the worker that creates the topic. how did that help you shape pretty much the rest of your career by focusing doing that master's degree program?
Yeah, that's a, you know, something I still wrestle with sometimes, you know, because I look back on it and I still am in touch with my colleagues there, and even the students come to visit me where I live now in Boston on a semi-regular basis. And I see that same bewilderment on their face that I had for a while I was going through that experience. You know, what I learned at the Architectural Association was the beginning, right? It wasn't the end. Like I think a lot of us thought it was going to be. It was sort of a year and a half, an intense year and a half to figure out the beginnings and not the ends. And that's the hardest thing to learn and to relearn things that you already sort of take for granted and know. I think how it fit into me is that we utilized tools that measure building performance. But typically, who measures building performance? Building performance usually measured by sustainability analysts or mechanical engineers or others to talk about the result that is the result of the end product. And the big difference was that we were using those analysis tools to drive what would become the design. And that was just turning the process upside down. And, you know, I wouldn't say that I mastered it while I was there, but the point wasn't to master it. The point was to understand what are the levers that you can pull. And then you go out into the world and then you figure out when to pull them and how to pull them and which tools to pull them with. And you know, I look back and it all makes a lot of sense to me now. But at the time, it was sort of, you know, bewildering is the word that comes to mind.
That's funny that you say mastering it. In fact, master's degree program is the tip of the iceberg. And it makes a lot of sense. It's like if you're not continuing that same area developing it over the next 10 years, then it's like a waste. Like it's that degree is just a starting point. It's like a shooting for a race that's starting. So I totally agree with that. I think we're going to look at maybe some of your work and accomplishment. Your passion for sustainable architecture is evident in your work and accomplishments and how you communicate them. What drives this passion and what do you hope to achieve through your leadership in this area?
It's interesting that my passion for this topic doesn't wane. Like sometimes I get a bit cynical because we all run into teammates that don't care or clients that don't care or budgets that can't accommodate the thing that we should be doing, right? And so, you know, you're always fighting reality in a way, but you can't look at it that way, because if you do, then everything feels like an adversarial engagement. And, you know, if you start to be a little more generous about how you think about the opportunities and saying, well, look, I'm helping no matter what. And the result of my career is being the person that gets to work on the fun projects that are doing the most and the most good, if you want to think of it that way, is something that keeps you going and keeps you motivated. It's interesting being a sustainability focused architect and being known for that, because people automatically expect wisdom to come from your results as opposed to other people's results, which they may like more. It also comes with a bit of guilt too. I was recently speaking at a conference and I was given the keynote at this conference, and I changed my entire speech as we went through the introduction, because it was a small event facilitated by an individual manufacturer. And they wanted me to come there and talk about sustainability. And everybody went around the room and introduced themselves. And they all started sort of shaming themselves and saying, like, oh, I'm alone in this work. Or I've asked my family not to send me Christmas cards to be more sustainable. And I was like, oh, my God, this is terrible. I was like, this is the problem, guys. So I think that what I do is to help people realize that we're on a journey together. There's a spectrum of outcomes that we can achieve. And it'd be great if we could do them all. But the point is not to do them all, it's to do all that we can with what we know and what we can do. Because what happens is when people feel guilt and shame is they'll avoid the whole topic altogether. And so, you know, I try to help carry the torch for the maybe not the best pun or analogy that you can use in a sustainability talk, but I try to carry the torch for the things that are the most flammable on the project and make sure that carries us throughout the duration. And at the end, people are always happy with the results. And it's really just us on the design and construction team that know the stories about the things that didn't happen, you know. So it keeps you motivated because it's always changing, it's always evolving, it's become its own discipline now. It gets a lot more respect than it used to get. And, you know, if I were to summarize everything, I would just say I feel very lucky to have gotten into it because it wasn't an option when I was making kind of big decisions in my life. And it's something I've stuck with all these years.
And we're going to get into some of your projects upcoming. We're going to take a little bit of a break. We learned so much more, and we'll come back after the break and learn a lot more about how people also can get involved with that.
You're listening to Architecture Beyond, an exciting new podcast about life after architecture and the stories of those taking the gifts to impact the world beyond the studio. We are speaking with lead fellow Blake Jackson about the world of sustainability and how sustainable design can be a more natural part of your workflow in architecture projects. If you are interested in learning more about architecture technology and the latest industry methods, check out our sponsor, thinkparametric.com.
So now we're going to talk about part of this interview of really finding out some of the projects by Blake. And I think he has a little bit that he could talk about each one, and I think that it would definitely give some good examples. First question is, with a wealth of experience and knowledge, can you talk about some of the key projects and initiatives that have been particularly impactful in your career and how they've contributed to your success as a leader with sustainability?
Sure. You know, I've got to give credit to the USGBC for creating the LEED rating system, because for better or for worse, it's been one of the more useful things I learned along the way. It's something I use constantly, and it's a sort of has become the lingua franca, so to speak, of sustainability and the way that we think about it. And again, for better or for worse, because sometimes that can be a bit limiting, but also it's nice to have a common language because that didn't exist before the 90s. When we were talking about building performance and holistic sustainability approaches. So I do have to say that that is one of the strings that pulls together 2006 when I had my conversion moment to now and today and tomorrow as well. I can guarantee that. You know, one of the other big opportunities that I didn't realize how important the impact was going to be was when I became a director of sustainability for the first time at a company called Choi Covis and Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So they, at that time, were a single office, mid-sized firm, about 75 staff. And one day, early in to me figuring out my role, I was only there for a few months. One of the principals came by and she said, I've volunteered you for the Green Guide for Healthcare. And she's like, so you're going to be getting a call once a week and do whatever this person tells you to do. And I was like, but I remember in my mind thinking, but I'm employed full time and you just volunteered me to do something for free on which is going to take a lot of my own time. And I remember sort of having a bit of a childish response to it internally, of course, because I thought, well, I mean, you do what you're told, right? It's 2010 and we don't want to go back to 2008, 2009 employment status. So I was like, fine, I'll start doing these calls. And I really didn't enjoy it at first because I just thought, man, this is extra work and this is, you know, very time consuming, and it's more than just an hour a week. But at some point I began to participate as opposed to fight and struggle with the fact that this was this thing that I had been told to do. And from that lesson, I learned that that was where leadership happens. It doesn't necessarily happen just on the projects and just in the firm. Because I was a researcher with the Green Guide for Healthcare. That relationship extended for almost 2.5 years. And I built a database of clients across 65 international healthcare facilities and really became, as a very young working professional, a trusted resource for sustainability and design, construction, and operations for hospitals. And that led to this huge research project that was presented at various different conferences and now has become part of evidence-based approaches that were catalyzed in 2013 within the launching of LEED for Healthcare. And it was that little bit of leadership beyond just the I show up to do my job and I go home kind of mentality that I realized, like, oh, I really actually like doing research and I actually like doing client engagement and I like doing marketing and I like doing peer-reviewed journal authorship, and I like speaking at conferences, and this is fun. And now, you know, it's how you become a leader, and nobody trains you how to do that. It takes a little bit of luck, which I received when I was voluntold to do something that initially I didn't want to do. And then from that moment on, I was signing up for everything because I realized at some point I can do my job and do it very well. And I don't want to say with my hands tied behind my back, but with a lot less stress and fatigue about it than you know, in the beginning when I was trying to kind of figure it all out. And so as things get easier, you fill the room in your career and your life with other things that give your soul food, so to speak. And, you know, that was a really valuable lesson that, you know, if we had talked about it, I might have been able to talk my way out of it. But because I fell into it, I learned to kind of love it. And, you know, I take on all kinds of things like that now. And those things are things that interest me, but they also tie back into my core career as well.
Wow. I like that soul food comment in terms of leadership. Like, leadership without a soul is how we get a lot of maybe just politicians in the field. But when you have that meaning,
it comes to mind, right? Yeah. Just bureaucracies, you know. Yeah, you know, you should love what you're doing, right? I mean, we were
like
told
regulatory agencies.
Yeah, it's just which are fighting the minimum, right? Like they're focusing on compliance when it's like, well, that's just the minimum, right? Like, what is it that we can do? How can we expand this? How can we do more and enjoy it? And, you know, that's how you win awards. That's how you do the things that we want to do. It's not by doing the minimum. It's not by just showing up and you work these hours and then you leave. It's actually by putting in the work. And so you just have to find ways of putting in the work that are enjoyable. Not always obvious.
I think there's one thing I want to look into. How do you now, at this point in your career, after working with several firms, working internationally, how do you define sustainability in architecture? And what are some key principles that architects should keep in mind when designing sustainable buildings?
The AIA 2030 commitment really does a good job in defining this. And the AIA in the last decade has really elevated the profession to define design excellence through health and evidence-based approaches and sustainability and resiliency and equity and there will be more. And I think that's one of the things about sustainability that's so exciting is that it's not just sustainability and numbers and metrics. It's change agency, right? We're trying to change the industry and how things are manufactured, how things are designed, how they're constructed. So, you know, I do like the 2030 methodology just because it's simple and it creates a simple framework whereby which we can actually measure our impacts portfolio wide. And the way I explain the commitment is that it's like looking into the mirror. And if you like what you see, then keep doing what you're doing. And if you don't like what you see, well, then you yourself have to decide to make a change. But it is just it's just data. What you do with it is important. And, you know, so it makes you focus on the things that we as architects influence the most, which are window to wall ratios, building performance, embodied carbon, and also a little bit deeper, who does that work and how often are we doing it? And are we doing it just for certain types of projects or are we doing it as a part and parcel of our culture and who we are? And the firms that meet the commitment are the ones that have institutionalized it. And those that haven't are the ones that are doing it on as a friend of mine refers to it, as random acts of sustainability. And so we're trying to get beyond just random acts of sustainability or only caring when our clients care to making everyone a carbon ambassador. And the commitment is a tool to do that. Better than others, I'll admit, just because it focuses you on thinking about the portfolio-wide impacts and not just the special projects.
That's a great point. What are some projects that you are seeing, maybe even working on now or you worked on in the past, that really demonstrate sustainable excellence versus, of course, just the minimums, really achieving something with sustainability in architecture?
You know, when I look back on my best project, so when we first met, my ego was a little too big for this screen, and like it's kind of calmed down a lot over the years. And the thing that I've learned that feels the best is not just the awards that you win, or the projects that you win, because there's always a loser. You win, someone else loses in this sort of dog eat dog world, right? It's a very competitive world that we exist in, right? But beyond that, because you win as many as you lose, right? So beyond that, what I've learned that feels the best is when you have people that have been impacted by your building that tell you how great it is. I'll give you a couple of examples where that happened, a couple of key project highlights. One is from I worked on this project for 9 years at two different architecture firms. That's how big the project was. It was an adaptive reuse of a ruin of a historically significant power station, the old Narragansett power plant along the banks of the Providence River in downtown Providence, Rhode Island. And it was in a part of town that was historically cut off from the downtown urban core by an overpass that in 2009, 2010, they decided to tear it down. And when they tore it down, it opened up, I think, something like 60 acres of urban redevelopment opportunity in and around the hospital in downtown Providence. That just happened to be north of the hurricane barrier. So it was this ripe opportunity. Yet the only building that existed there, and it's difficult to develop in Rhode Island. I don't want to get into the specifics of that unless you really want to, but it's hard. There was this historically significant power plant, huge building that was falling in on itself, and the only way to save it was to actually let it be the catalyst for the urban redevelopment of this entire area, like 60 acres. And so instead of creating nursing education facilities at Brown University, Rhode Island College, University of Rhode Island, they actually partnered together to invest with a developer in this site so that they could bring that vision to life because it happens to be right, walking distance to Providence Hospital. And so we did a lot with that project. So it's historically significant. So it was paid for 50% by tax credits alone, just by preserving the building. Which means we saved a ton of embodied carbon, and we saved a little bit of the heritage from the early 1900s that had been wiped out from that area because the highway came through and it eradicated a lot of these old, beautiful buildings. And this building in particular was pretty great. It also serves as an extension of their river walk there. So it has this social value. And Providence is fantastic because they have this thing called water fire, where in the summer months and in the fall, they actually have gondolas that go up and down the river, and this artist has created this experience where there's these huge urns that burn these cedar logs, and you can just smell it from all around the town. And thousands of people come around and just watch this thing happen, and listen to music, and watch live performances, and eat food, and everything. It's really enjoyable, and it's an extension of that now. There's even a place for the gondolas to land and on the river now because this building is no longer an eyesore that's dangerous. It's something that it transformed the whole neighborhood. And now when you go there, there's parks and there's housing and there's new mass transit stops. And that project enabled that whole neighborhood to unlock in conjunction with the pulling down of the highway overpass. Another project highlight, no relation, was the Jackson Laboratory in Farmington, Connecticut. So this was a speculative project that we built for an institutional client who wanted to create a world center for genomic research and excellence in Connecticut. And we actually went after the project in 2010. It was awarded to another state and another team. And then the political climate changed. The project went back on the market in 2012. We went after it again and we won it. Now, we built this beautiful facility, state-of-the-art research facility in Farmington, Connecticut, which is about 7 miles outside of Hartford. And it has to compete with New York, Silicon Valley, Singapore, anywhere that's doing genomics, right? And I was invited to come there to talk about the sustainability metrics on the site. And the client is, they love the building. We save them over $200,000 a year in operational costs through energy efficiency measures we built into the building. It's LEED Gold certified. It won Connecticut Green Building of the Year in 2016 and the prestigious I2SL for Sustainable Laboratory Design Award in 2015. So it did all the things that it's supposed to do. They invited me for a sort of a tenant appreciation day on Earth Week in 2017, I think, in 2016, excuse me, to talk about the green attributes of the building. And in those conversations, there were so many researchers that came to me that just wanted to gush about how much they loved the building and how they, I remember in particular this one British chap who came up and he said, you know, he was some kind of big deal researcher in genomics. And he said, I was going to go to Silicon Valley until I toured this building. And he said, I chose to come to Connecticut to do my research because this is the only facility in the world where I could do my thing. And I was like, man, that's awesome. And, you know, you don't plan that out. It's the kind of, well, you do actually, you try to plan that out, but that will happen. But it's so nice when it does happen. And people just kept talking about how flexible the building was and how they, you know, they relocated from states away and countries away to come and live and work there. And it's just like, man, that's amazing. It's amazing the impact that you have. And we always hope to have it, but it's nice to get it back. And it's like, that's when you know you've got something great.
I've been to Rhode Island once. I have some family there, but I definitely have had some time in Connecticut. So I think making that impact meant a whole lot. And that's actually the best sign for architects. I think in school, because we're just dealing with professor or you know, maybe some firms, you know, it stops being about that till you get past the point of just making ends meet or something, you know, but that point of impacting people and communities, you have to get through a point to really start seeing that. And I think that really demonstrates with both of those projects that you actually achieved something with architecture. I think the historians, that's I have a little bit of a critique against some historians.
No, you know, it gets me into this conversation that I have with students now, because I get invited to speak at a lot of schools and to talk to students and to judge their work. And you know, I genuinely want to come from a place of helping them, but I can't help myself. Every now and again, I'll catch one that's just being novel for the sake of novelty. And I think that that's something that I think that's a tough habit to get our architecture out of, is because it's one thing to be novel, right? I mean, and I'm not saying with architecture should be bland and boring and mundane and pedestrian and backdrop. I'm not saying that at all, but to be novel is not novel for the sake of novelty, and it's very difficult to determine which is which.
You're talking about the red cape architect syndrome, where we look at architects like Frank Lloyd Wright as this international architect. And there are a lot of these small decisions where he was able to start something that someone would take that road on. That's something that people miss with history. That's sort of my critique of the star architect, where students following it, they're not making impact with their designs except for how it looks, the spectacle. Whereas leading and creating a role like director of sustainability and seeing it through to the end of a project that's affecting communities, and like, people know you and they know your work and your team, and continuing to do that successfully, that's a real target for architects to achieve. I think that really speaks on that.
We've also become specialists too in our field. So you know, most practicing architects focus on maybe one or two building types. You know, if you focus on healthcare, you're a healthcare architect and you don't do anything else. And for some, that's a gift. You know, the thing I like about sustainability is it's a philosophy about how we should and can design, construct, and operate buildings. And as such, we get to be sort of the last generalist, because I don't get put into a bucket of just doing healthcare or just doing multifamily residential or just doing academic buildings. I get to see it all and all different scales. So in particular with my last job, I was working on single level, partial floor, interior fit out projects, all the way up to, you know, 21 building, 50 year master plans with an urban resiliency sea level, anti-sea level rise bend, you know. So the only way to do that is through sort of a generalization. And I didn't know that was going to be the case when I got into this business, but it's something that also keeps it very interesting, because you get to see a lot of how architecture is generated across multiple building types. That is a thing of the past. It doesn't get to, not everybody gets to see that anymore.
What are some of the biggest challenges that architects face when designing sustainable buildings, and how can they overcome those challenges?
I don't think it's just sustainability. It's all of our industry is being asked to do more on a shorter timeline with less resources. And I joke often that when I look at these RFPs for projects, that at some point the client's going to lease us a mouse, and however many times we click it, they're going to charge us for it. And it's like, how many clicks, can you name that tune with the architecture, right? And it's like, how many clicks till you get to the results? And so I think that time is the thing that we're fighting the most. And time being that, unfortunately, our industry has kicked the can for a long time relative to acknowledging climate change and the impact that architecture has. So we need to go back and re-educate ourselves. I had a terminal degree in architecture, and then I had to go and get yet another one because to focus on the thing that I care about the most, right? And when I was taking the AREs, there was one sentence about sustainability, and it was a sentence that said sustainability is architecture that generally it said something, I'm paraphrasing here, but it said sustainable architecture is generally architecture that focuses on building performance more than aesthetics. And I thought, well, what a great way to sell it, guys. So we need to re-educate very quickly. We've got to retool the way we manufacture. We've got to extract all the carbon out of the atmosphere that we've emitted over 300 years. Like, time is the thing that we are fighting, and we're running out. And there's a lack of urgency around that topic that makes people feel uncomfortable. But the reality of the situation is we don't, people ha don't have enough time. I don't have enough time to educate everybody and make them care as much as I do. The complexity of the situation is enormous and makes people feel like they don't have time to care because of it. And then there's the project timeline, which keeps getting reduced and reduced and reduced. And the technology is making it as such that we can deliver more projects more quickly. So it's not saving us any time either. It's just actually giving us more stress and more to do. So I think time is the thing that we're fighting the most. More than money, more than time, and I would say the word heart comes to mind. And when I say heart, I think more in terms of willpower. So all the tools to save us from a climate catastrophe exist today. I mean, except for nuclear fission or fusion, excuse me. That'll help reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but we just have to decide that we want to build buildings better. I mean, there are warehouses full of solar panels that are completely in shade, not connected to the grid. And it's like part of me wants to just break into them, scatter them about the desert, and connect them into the grid so they can do something. And it's like, well, why aren't we doing something with what we have available to us, which would actually have a pretty big impact? I mean, Paul Hawken pointed out his book Drawdown in 2016 that if we just changed out all the inefficient lighting in the world with LEDs, it will reduce greenhouse gas emissions something like 3%. So, I mean, we just have to exercise willpower. So, willpower and time.
I guess could you delve a little bit deeper into sort of solving those time or complexity or heart challenges? Like, what are some key ways, I guess, easy steps to really start in that process?
Well, you've got to show people what's possible. And you've got to help them understand that they play a role in it. And they say, well, I don't care. I don't know. It's too complicated. It's like, well, look, if you don't care a little bit, and that's why I'm here as a sort of specialist, right? But you need to care a little bit enough to include the specialization, because if you don't, it'll have a bigger negative impact than the positive impact that we could have if we worked on it a little bit together. And that's a challenge. It's a real challenge. And again, it's also a physical challenge of being one person that can't be on every project at all times, right? So you have to train people and enable them to be able to do things and show them that it's possible within a timeline, because the second that things get too complicated to do, they go back to the old ways of doing things. And so, that's really it, and people are always amazed. I don't know. It's funny when you do analyses on things. Like, we just did a daylight analysis on a correctional facility that we're working on to try to humanize the space a little bit. And it's like magic when you show people, like, well, if you put the skylights here and in this configuration, then you get a spatial daylight autonomy, which is a measure of the impact of daylighting on the space, of X versus Y. And they look at the options and it's just like a miracle, right? It's like, wow, we can actually, you can predict that? And it's like, yeah, we can predict it. Indiana Jones could predict it with the staff and the ruby and the pyramid and all this stuff. So it's like, we can do that too. So making it, integrating it with the workflow is crucial. And it's not trying to solve all the problems at once. It's trying to solve the problem that presents itself today, right now. So we're looking at potentially relocating a major headquarters of a international company right now. And everyone's like, well, what do we do to think about sustainability? And I say, let's just talk to the broker and figure out where the best walk score, transit and bike score locations are. And it's as simple as that. And if we can hone in on buildings with green operations, then that's a two for one. You know, so it's not thinking about all the metrics of lighting and materials, transparency and everything that we could think about right away. It's about dissecting the problem in a way that says, oh, we're just looking at an address. Well, let's pick the best one. And well, how do you pick the best one for sustainability? Well, can you walk there, drive there, bike there? Does it have electric vehicles? Is there a place to get a coffee? Is there a place to grab lunch so that people aren't having to go far away to do it? Does it facilitate collaboration? Does it have access to daylight and views? And these aren't sustainability questions, right? These are common sense, logical, quality questions, right? So I think sometimes sustainability can be a double-edged sword in terms of a concept. It brings out different emotions from different people. So if you can cloak it in terms of outcomes that people want and don't use the dreaded S word, that sometimes works for people that are skeptical.
If you make it into a mountain, it's going to look like a mountain that you have to cross versus bring in the ideas in that are easy and easy to digest. That's a real easy way to just get that process started. And then, yeah, you'll show them and they will see that.
Our grandparents, right? They were sustainable without making a thing about it, right? You know, like every meal was home cooked, free range. Like they reused their socks and turned them into quilts. You know what I mean? Like it's only us that made it a thing, you know?
And I'm really getting so much out of this conversation. I know the audience and listeners will as well. My question is, how can architects use storytelling and communication to engage with clients, communities, and stakeholders about the importance of sustainable architecture?
This is the thing that I try the hardest to do. I think a lot of sustainability-focused architects and professionals get bogged down in the weeds of the rules and the numbers and the credits and the process. You know, nobody else is expected to do that except for us. Like, we always have to. You know, it's funny. I feel like when we show a design option, people are expecting it to do a whole lot more. Whereas with somebody who's not bogged down with that baggage, if they show a design option, it's just binary. It's like, oh, that's cool. Or no, I wouldn't do that. You know, so it moves faster if you do it that way. So, you know, my job is to make the hard part go away. And that's what a specialist does. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't need to make a thing about it. They just need to do it, do it well. But then it's like, okay, well, how do you translate what you did into something that people want? And most people don't, you know, most people want the elevator pitch, especially nowadays, things that are complicated. They want the 5-second tweet or the emoji, right? We're on emojis now. We're not even writing words any longer. And I keep hearing that reading is disappearing. So, you know, if we can make things quick and simple to understand, and what do people understand? They understand and are motivated by their wants and needs. So if we can make people want something, then that's compelling. So I think that sustainability offers that story. And then, you know, what's interesting is if you give somebody something that they want, then they'll say, well, tell me more. And then you get into the weeds about how you arrived at the solution and these multiplicity of impacts that are beyond just the immediacy of the thing that you helped them to want, that they should want. And so I think that storytelling has that capability. I think that the other opportunity that we have right now that's never presented itself before is that clients, and particularly publicly traded clients, are obliged to care or legally required to care through ESG initiatives. Mm-hmm. And if you can connect, so the ESG initiatives are the environmental social governance platforms of the world. They're generally written by somebody who's not your client, but they're written by somebody who's a vice president or at least an equal to your client. And it's abstract for them to understand how the work that they're doing connects to the thing that the company is trying to do. And so what it gives me and others an opportunity is to link those two things together. And so what I spend a lot of time doing right now is getting to know a client's building problem or challenge and opportunity. And also, well, what is it that your ESG is saying? And if it's saying that we have to decarbonize by 2030 and we're starting a project in 2023 that'll be built in 2028, you've got to figure out that. Wow. Because 2 years is not enough time to get there. But by holding a mirror, and I call it the ESG mirror, by holding up the ESG mirror and showing them, here's what your company says is your mandate. Now let's talk about how do we do that in the building. It becomes more like a story. And it's not a story about you and how clever you are. It's a story about them and what they're trying to do. And they, when they understand it, then they understand that the building is a part of that story, or the interior, or the master plan, or the product is a part of that story. Then it's easy to get the buy-in because they see how it fits into the life of the entity, often the company.
I have sort of two-part question. It's sort of how, what are some important tools that can help architects with sustainability, and how can architects maybe who are finishing colleges or starting out, how can they start to go down that route to really start achieving work in sustainability?
Okay, great. You know, some tools that are available to us, there are many now, and what's great about them is that they are multifaceted. So when I was going through architecture school at the Architectural Association, we had a tool for daylighting, a tool for natural ventilation, and a tool for this and that and the other. And what we kept finding was that we would refine one model. Oh yeah. And then there's the model that you use to sell the design, which is the rendering and it looks cool and photorealistic and all that kind of stuff, right? And what we found was that you could optimize a building in one model for daylighting, but then when you went through the process of modeling it for natural ventilation, it didn't really work that well. So you'd have to adjust it for that. And then you'd have to take it and export it into the daylight model and then adjust that. And then you found that it didn't really work for daylighting anymore. So you're constantly having to do all this modeling and balancing that we don't have to do anymore because we have tools now that are
in every major suite as well.
Revit
and SketchUp.
Yeah, the plugins, Grasshopper, Rhino, plugins to Revit, plugins to SketchUp that enable you to do building performance. And change things dynamically with the click of a button, as opposed to having to set up an entire individual model to look at one attribute of a building that I wish that we had had when I was in school, because it would have fit together a little bit better in terms of how do we impact it. Some tools that come to mind are IES. IES is probably the best one. It's ones that we use. They use it at the Architectural Association now. We use it in our energy modeling component of our company. You know, that's really more of a specialization. One of the challenges, we just had this conversation this morning with my global sustainability team. So we have about 12 people across the world that are helping me to focus on this challenge. And one of the big, I think it's the big challenge of sustainability, is helping architects understand that their decisions impact building performance. And it's not just we design a building and then we hand it to the engineers and then they figure it out. And then it's a dial that we can say, oh, can we adjust the, because we're not focusing on energy percentage reduction any longer. We're focused on carbon. And when you focus on carbon, you can apples to apples compare a building using its energy use intensity or EUI or its greenhouse gas emissions retention intensity. And those aren't numbers that you can easily dial up or down. Those are numbers that are a response to the decisions that are driven by architecture, the envelope, the thermal resistance of the glazing, the roof, the floor slabs, the exterior walls, and the overall building form. And we're in a situation right now where the cost of everything has doubled and tripled over the last few years. We have a housing crisis, we have an affordability crisis, and we've got inflation. Wonderful. And so, you know, we need to be very creative about how we design the future to meet the need, because despite all those things, people keep coming through the conveyor belt of life. And so they are going to need spaces, they are going to need homes and communities. And so we have to get very creative about how we build this literacy around carbon to be able to meet those needs of the future.
I don't know how much you've had the experience with Ladybug Suite. The Ladybug Suite, they have a new app called Pollinator that works both in some BIM product. And this is more on the technical side. I know it's about those concepts too. But I was wondering, what impact are you seeing with tools like Ladybug? What are you seeing in terms of the impact of, you know, small teams, not just big teams, to be able to use that? And even some of the power of the Ladybug suite is that it's using like these big open source entities, some from national laboratories, national standards about like energy usage. Like the recent one I did is a honeybee course about energy analysis, and it plugs straight into, you know, national statistics for what particular type of program, what type of building systems are. The tools make it easier versus the homework where you have to actually maybe do a little more calculation.
That's the thing, is you've got to be able to interpret the results. And so that's something that I've been spending a lifetime working on. I've never been the best user of those tools. How we are using them is that there are many mandates now. So used to sort of sustainability, in a way it was more fun, because when somebody came to you and said, I want a LEED Gold building, it was almost like playing darts. You're like, well, let's try a little of this and a little of that. And you're coming up with the recipe, and then you simulate it, and then you interpret the results. And that can only get you so far, and it won't get you as far as we need to go. So what I'm starting to see now in terms of use of parametric analysis on the energy modeling side is that we can work backwards from the results that we want. And generally, they're very simple results, such as all electric net zero building. And we can work backwards from all the options that give us that, as long as we have a building form. If we know what climate it's, I always tell my students, if you're doing an energy model, you can do an energy model at any point of the process, as long as you know how much you have, where it's located, and what it is. Because if it's a 100,000 square foot lab building, it will use a lot more energy than if it's a 100,000 square foot classroom building. And so if you know those three variables or more, you can run a model and get meaningful results. Now imagine that you have a building that you know is going to be 100,000 square feet, three floors, and it's going to be X big because it fits on the site. And those are all things that are determined by an architect and a client. You can throw every possible technology at that, every possible R value and every possible window to wall ratio into an algorithm, and then work backwards from the results, and it'll narrow it down to the bundles of strategies that get the results. And usually there's only about five or six variations. And then if you work with a cost estimator, that's the one piece that we don't have access to, is the cost estimation side. You can arrive at the bundles that you can afford. And we have leveraged that on projects that on a budget, on a developer's budget, net carbon neutral, all electric status, because we started the design of the project knowing what the bundles were that got us there, and we weren't doing the dark plank. And it's less fun that way, but the computer can deal with that level of complexity. And then if you're working with your contractor, they can deal with the supply chain and the availability and the lead time issues. So that has changed building performance modeling and turned it completely upside down for the positive.
I think I'm understanding that as don't just get lost in that software can do a printout. Definitely be looking at that interpretation as well as that tool. If you're learning it, learn those both elements. That's going to be pretty key.
Yeah. Well, and you still need us to interpret the results, right?
So yes. So get those consultant and get that guide. Wow.
Well, on a project, for example, we ended up spending more, where we utilized that workflow I just described. We ended up spending more money on the thermal envelope. We could have gotten away with a different mechanical strategy and a less expensive thermal envelope, but we actually went with the more expensive thermal envelope because the best performing option that we could afford was the one that had an in-floor hydronic heating and cooling system. And what that doesn't enable in a commercial scenario is for you to cut holes in the floors, because if you cut a hole in the floor, then suddenly the hydronic system on the other end of the hole cut from the source of energy being pumped through it gets severed. And because of flexibility for a commercial building, we said, well, you know, just we never know who's going to lease in this building. Why don't we Why don't we not create that Achilles heel just in case they want to put a communicating stair or a fire pole or whatever in the building, you know? So we went with a more expensive option that we could also afford that met our goals, that gave us the long-term flexibility that we needed. And a
Wow.
computer cannot work through that process yet, to my knowledge.
Yeah. No. AI might, you never know, but at the same time, that just shows the level of development. I think we have like one or two questions. Just the question of, again, that what is that start point for a career in the sustainability specialization for an architect?
I'm glad you asked this question because I get a lot of calls from young, about to graduate professionals, sometimes in engineering, sometimes in architecture or interior design. And they say, I want to get into sustainability. And I tell them, not yet. The answer is always not yet. And the reason why is because I encourage them to graduate with their degree that they're focused on, and then actually go into practice. So if they have a degree in mechanical engineering, I'm like, look, if you want to learn about sustainability, do it on your own time while you're learning how to actually be a mechanical engineer, or actually learn how to be an interior designer. Because if you don't know what their pain points and their process and their workflow and their life is like, you can't help them as a sustainability consultant. And I think that's one of the things that helped me as a sustainability consultant was being a, you know, I finished my architectural licensure during my first couple of years as a dedicated sustainability professional. But I had worked for years swinging hammers. I worked in construction, on the desk side of construction, not the hammer swinging side of construction. I was an intern architect for hospitality and retail firms and restaurants. So at least I had a practical experience that I could reflect back on and say, why am I having a hard time reaching this person or that? Or how do I integrate with the workflow? And the other key component of this for their long-term personal success is that for them to be a licensed professional will also increase their long-term money-making capability. So for example, if you're a sustainability consultant, no PE, and you've got a degree in mechanical engineering, you'll start here, whereas a junior mechanical engineer will start here, and you'll progress over time accordingly. And so my point is to say that you've got to be double valuable. You've got to like learn about sustainability and come in at this level of pay grade, and then you'll be really valuable as you go throughout time. And I've had 100% success rate of people taking me up on that advice, thankfully.
That's cool. That's cool. And I suppose that's also with Boston Architectural College, as well as UMass. Maybe some of those guys you also give the guidance to in that direction.
Yeah, the only place that's a little unique is with regard to the Boston Architectural College because it's more of an apprenticeship model education, which is really fascinating, actually. So you're not in that conundrum of do you have, you know, if you have a 5-year degree in architecture and you never set foot in an architecture firm, when you graduate, you go to get a job and they say, well, where's your work experience? And then there's some people that are really good at drafting that never got a degree, and then they go to get a job and they say, well, you can't get licensed, so we're going to pay you like a drafter, right? So the BAC is this model where it's open from 4 to
And
10 months.
your role there is
I've been an adjunct professor there since 2012, and I teach sustainable building systems to architects, interiors, landscape architects, and design studies majors. And I was going to say the design studies majors are the ones that I just say, you know what, go on and get into the field because it's not an accredited program like architecture, engineering, landscape architecture, and even interiors. They are focused on being consultants only, you know. So for them, it's, you know, they position themselves to be really great support staff for a person like myself or for consultancies that just focus on that. Not to say that they won't grow into owning and managing those companies someday, but I'm just saying that for them, I say, well, the place to go into is the sustainability field. So it can embrace them in that way. So I give a little different advice to the design studies majors as I do to the ones that suffer through the architecture degrees and the engineering degrees. Not to say that the design studies students don't suffer themselves, but you know, they made the choice to position themselves in such a way.
It's more of the architectural focus. You can, it's just like you know that industry, you have so much more to offer. in that direction versus just a general sustainable focus.
Well, I don't think it's more to offer. I think it's just you've made the choice to do architecture. So see that through, learn it through it, and then approach sustainability through that lens. Just like an MEP engineer has gone through that education and needs to see through that part of their career so that they can approach sustainability through that lens. The design studies majors are going to be more generalized. They're not going to be architects or engineers, but they'll have a little bit of both in ways that they need to see that through, right? So it's an all hands on deck approach where architects think like engineers and behave sustainably, and engineers think like engineers and architects, and they behave sustainably, and everybody sort of raising the ships together, so to speak. But that's kind of the approach that I give.
That's very good. And that's very insightful as well. Blake, thank you so much for joining us. I want to sort of give the audience a chance to find out what's going on with Blake Jackson and some of your work. Where can the audience find you, and where can they find out more about developing and sustainability?
Sure. Well, follow us. You can follow me on various different social media platforms. I'm a pretty big LinkedIn user. There's also our company website, www.norr.com, and its social media channels. And also, I'm pretty active at various different conferences and things around the world. So I'm sure I'll be in a town near somebody if they want to grab coffee or tea or a drink or something. I'm always willing to drink or eat something. So I'm a pretty easy to be in, a person to be in touch with in that regard. But definitely social media, our website, and you'll see a lot of me if you start to follow.
Thanks a lot, and I will put that link in that information. Thanks so much for joining us, Blake.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. It's good to see you again, buddy.
It was great speaking with lead fellow Blake Jackson and learning about effective ways to bring in sustainability and sustainable consultants for effective environmentally sensitive projects. For more information, you can find Blake at LinkedIn or in AEC and upcoming sustainability conferences. If you are interested in learning more about architecture technology and the latest industry methods, check out our sponsor, thinkparametric.com, and check out the Think Parametric newsletter this week in architecture. In the next episode, our topic is an introduction to the world of BIM residential design in Revit, where you will learn the best ways to combine design and productivity in the timeless craft of making homes. Be sure to check it out.
This has been Brandon and the Architecture Beyond crew. Catch you in the next episode.